Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk.
Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Tony Edwards. How are you, Tony?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent, excellent. You've just written a book called The Good News About Wine, which sounds fantastic.
Not quite right. The Good News About Booze.
Booze, yeah, yeah.
Good news, booze.
Yeah,
Think good news when you booze.
Yep, good news. The good news about booze. Okay, so that includes spirits as well.
It does, but that spirits are not nearly as good as you for you as wine.
But we're a wine show.
Okay, okay. Good news about wine.
Okay, I've just actually been to a presentation that you gave on wine and alcohol consumption as well as I've forgotten his name.
Forget him.
Forget him. What was his name again? Sorry.
Professor David Cahoon.
In the debate, it was really talking about alcohol consumption versus non-consumption, etc. But I'm more interested in your book and what your book's about. Do you want to tell us a bit about yourself first, and then maybe a wee bit about your journey publishing this book?
I'm an ex-television producer. I used to work for a programme called Horizon at the BBC. So I know quite a lot about science journalism. And I got into alcohol by accident a few years back when I was doing some research on calories. And it turns out that alcohol is very high in calories, but it doesn't put on weight. And I thought, hang on, this is really interesting. I wonder what else is interesting about alcohol. And I looked at started to look at the research data, and I found more and more things that actually were just completely mind-blowing, that actually alcohol is exceptionally good for your health in a number of important areas. Heart disease, diabetes, dementia, arthritis, even erectile dysfunction, alcohol is very good for. And actually that people who drink have a longer lifespan and a healthier lifespan than people who don't drink. So that's basically what the book's about. And the book is entirely based on scientific research, published in some of the most prestigious journals in the world, from some of the top scientists in the world. So it's not me telling you this, it's them telling you this through me, as it were. I'm just referring to their papers. And the reason I called it The Good News About Booze and made the title a bit jokey is because actually the book is just full of one scientific study after another. I've written it in a kind of jokey way, but actually the science is still absolutely kosher. And there is no question that alcohol is exceptionally good for your health as long as you drink moderately. You're going to ask me what moderate means here.
Well, moderate is the question, isn't it? What is moderation? That's the million-dollar question. I think most people agree that if you're drinking really heavily all the time, then you're going to get into some sort of health issues. I'm surprised about the calories, though, because I think of alcohol just as a mutant form of sugar that just makes you a bit merry.
There's no sugar to speak of in alcohol at all. There's no sugar in spirits, obviously, because they're just pure
carbohydrates.
There's very, very few carbohydrates in alcohol. The reason that alcohol is high in calories is because alcohol itself is the thing that's high in calories, not the carbohydrates. And the reason is that when you burn alcohol, it burns very fiercely, and calories are based on how much heat comes out when you burn things. So the calorie theory actually is a load of rubbish, because it's based on how much heat you get out of a food when you burn it. Fat burns hotter than most things, so fat has more calories in it. That's the theory, but it's actually not true. And so alcohol is almost as calorific as fat, but actually when you feed it to human beings, you give alcohol to human beings in a controlled laboratory basis, and you substitute food calories for alcohol calories. In other words, they're taking exactly the same amount of calories in, but you just give them alcohol instead of food for the same calories. They lose weight. Human beings lose weight, animals lose weight. It's a completely open and shut case. Alcohol calories are not bioavailable. The body does not recognize them. It can't assimilate them. So that was the thing that really got me into this whole area. And as I say, I looked at more and more of the research around alcohol. I thought, if you were a drug company, you could patent alcohol, you'd be laughing all the way to the bank. Because the health benefits are so absolutely outrageous, overwhelming evidence for health benefits. At moderate intake.
Some of the graphs I've seen show a typical hockey stick. You know, it's almost the profitability of a new business. Things go south pretty quickly. When, in this case, south is actually good for you. Reducing your risk. And then as your consumption increases, it gets steeper and steeper goes in the other direction. And so negative, really. Yeah. So that's how you got into the book. Tell me a bit about who the target audience of the book is, actually.
The thing is, there's a lot of science in the book, and I felt I had to put the science in because otherwise no one would believe me. And so there are 450 scientific references. Now, I've written it in such a way that the science is actually easy to understand, and there are quite a lot of graphs in the book which are fairly easy to understand, and there are a few jokes as well. So it's not all very heavy going, but the audience is an intelligent layman. You, me, everyone. Yeah. People who like their drink, who want to be given the information about what is safe and what isn't safe, what the benefits are and what the disbenefits are.
One of the issues that seems to have occurred with alcohol consumption anyway and the health lobby is that it's becoming quite polarized. The medical practitioners appear to be the ones saying this is what's good, this is what's not good. In the debate you've just had, I raised the question that maybe the medics aren't necessarily the best people. They do tend to see just one side of it. You know, you go to the doctor because you're ill, not because you're feeling great, and therefore they always see one side of the alcohol and not the positive side, and therefore they may not be the best people to make an informed decision about it. If it isn't the medical people, who is the best person, in your opinion, to really advise consumers?
Well, I agree with you 100%. Medics are the last people who should be giving advice because they only see the casualties of alcohol and not its beneficiaries. By definition, only sick people walk in through their front door. Now, in terms of who should be in charge of giving advice, I think nutritionists would be good because they tend to be more objective. I think actually civil servants are not a bad idea because they tend to be objective. They can look at the evidence dispassionately. And in fact, the 1995 guidelines, which have been superseded by the recent ones in last January, were done by civil servants. And they came up with the idea, with the suggestion, recommendation that actually you ought to drink a little bit of alcohol for your health. For the good of your health. And that got the medics really, really angry at the time. And they've had their own back now. 20 years later, they've waited and they've pounced and they've kind of just knocked the whole thing on the head. So I don't think doctors should be anywhere near the guidelines. I think nutritionists and civil servants should be people who are objective, who can read the evidence like I can, like anywhere you can. Anyone can go to PubMed, go online, look at the evidence in my book. I've given you the actual name, the details of the scientific papers where the evidence has come from. So you can look at it online and see whether I'm right or not. You'll see the actual original data.
One of the problems is that we've just said the medics may be slightly biased. The issue with your book is then, are you slightly biased in terms of cherry-picking the data that you'd like? Because doctors, in my opinion, Sally Davis has cherry-picked information. So the question is, have you cherry-picked the information?
Well, I mean, of course, I feel that I probably haven't. But in a way, the book is called The Good News About Booze because the only stuff we get to hear about is the bad news about booze. So in that sense, it gives you the opposite point of view. But I do show the downsides of alcohol drinking, of which the major one is cancer and cirrhosis of the liver. And I put those in context, and you see exactly how much the evidence tells you, how much evidence there is about the cancer and alcohol risk. And it's not as strong as you think, and it's not nearly as strong as we're told. And also, surprisingly, when you drink, you have a reduced risk of certain cancers. So actually, all in all, when you look at the death rates of cancer amongst drinkers, it's almost flat line. It's almost a flat line.
It was interesting when you were talking in the debate, you mentioned Sheffield a couple of times as being sort of the hotbed of anti-alcohol. Why Sheffield? What's going on in Sheffield? Who's there? And what's the situation there?
I am going to be careful here. Sheffield University, in my view, is the HQ of the anti-alcohol lobby, the academic HQ of the anti-alcohol lobby in the UK. And it's interesting that Dame Sally Davis chose Sheffield, or her advisers chose Sheffield, to give her the lowdown on alcohol and its risks. So actually the Sheffield University people have come up with a graph which nobody else believes in. A very strange J-curve, which is like a hockey stick thing, but one that has not appeared in any other scientific paper. In fact, the evidence that Sheffield University came up with has not been peer-reviewed, as far as I know. It was entirely internal. And if you were to give that to anybody outside Sheffield who knows anything about alcohol, they would say this is nonsense. And in fact, Professor Jürgen Rehm, who was actually used by the British government to advise them on this recent thing, he told them very firmly, and he confirmed that in a BBC interview the other day, he said, I told them that actually a small amount of alcohol is very good for heart disease. They know that. I told them that. And he said they are wrong in suggesting that there aren't health benefits to alcohol.
One of the arguments that Sally Davis used was the fact that you can now take statins as an alternative to alcohol consumption, and therefore you don't need to necessarily take alcohol as a method of helping to manage heart disease. Do you want to comment on that?
Did she really say that?
That came out about a month after her initial statement.
Well, I know the Royal College of Physicians has said this some years ago, and I was absolutely staggered when I read this. Here they are suggesting that we take a drug that actually has a huge number of side effects, it's also quite expensive, and also, and thirdly, doesn't actually work very well. Take a drug instead of drinking a little bit of alcohol, which will do you good, both physically and mentally. I mean, it's just outrageous. I mean, how mad can you get to suggest taking a drug rather than having a glass of wine? I mean, it's nonsensical.
I looked at it and went, oh, this doesn't sound right, because I was on blood pressure pills for a while. I took them religiously for about a year, and then I just gave up because it was too much hassle. There was problems and issues, and I just stopped taking them and I forgot to take them. And my question is, if you are on something like statins, how long do people take them before they don't bother? Whereas I'm always going to have a glass of wine in the evening. So the question was, you know, from an epidemiological point of view, what proof have they got that long-term consumption of statins versus alcohol? And I don't know if there was any evidence on that.
As far as I know, no one's done a comparison, direct comparison, but the evidence is very clear that statins are inefficient at preventing heart disease. I think the latest figure was something you've got to 1,000 people have got to take statins every day for the whole of their lives for one person to not to die sooner than he would have done otherwise. Some ridiculous figure like that. I mean, the actual health benefits are so minute and the health risks are substantial. The side effects are really quite scary. The side effects of alcohol are not scary and they're rather pleasant. And also, the effect of alcohol is much stronger, much, much stronger than the beneficial effects of alcohol are much, much stronger in terms of heart disease than statins are, much stronger.
This debate is going on in the UK at the moment, but in the rest of the world, they seem to be following previous guidelines, although some countries, if you go to Russia, you seem to be able to drink as much as you like before you fall over and you're still considered healthy. So each country's got their own sort of levels of it, but the UK seems to be moving towards a very, very minimalistic approach to consumption, minimalist, I don't know if that, yeah. Low consumption rate anyway. How much out of whack is the UK heading compared to the rest of the world?
It is now considerably out of whack. It's out of whack with America in particular, where the American government has recently said, effectively, you ought to drink a little bit of alcohol for your health. Men ought to drink 4 units a day and women ought to drink 2 units a day for the benefit of their health. They don't quite put it as boldly as that, but effectively that's the message, whereas the message in the UK is all alcohol is dangerous and if you really must drink, don't drink more than 2 units a day, whatever it is. Now, France, the interesting thing is that we have, I mean, France, the French government, there are two parts of France where you've got the French medics who say you shouldn't drink more than 20 grams of alcohol a day, which is about 2 or 3 units, whereas another part of the French government said 60 grams a day is the maximum you should be drinking. So two parts of the same country have two different guidelines. By and large, Britain is the most draconian.
One other thing I'm quite interested about is liver function. There's a guy called Professor Gilmore. He used to bang on quite a bit about liver and chlorosis of the liver because that's his cup of tea, so to speak. And you do see that. You have seen, you know, in the statistics, steady rises in chlorosis of the liver in the UK at the same time as you're seeing steady drops in consumption of alcohol in the UK and a steady rise in sugar, which I understand does a similar effect on the liver as well. It's been rising quite steadily as well. And I get confused about what's the cause from the alcohol consumption and what's the cause from the sugar. All we know is that alcohol consumption is dropping, chlorosis is going up, and I don't understand why the two are being tied together as tightly as they are.
Well, of course, there's always a time lag between people ingesting things and the disease coming on afterwards. So that could be the reason why there's a divergence in the curves. But the other thing is that there's definitely a connection between cirrhosis of the liver and alcohol, because alcohol, the liver is precisely the place where alcohol gets detoxified. That's where it kind of makes it healthy for us to drink. And there is definitely an increase in cirrhosis, but it's not nearly as big as they tell you. When you do post-mortem studies of drinkers, which they've done in Finland, which is a heavy drinking country, they look, you know, in detail at their livers and carve them up and see exactly what. There's no cirrhosis whatever in men who drink up to 40 grams a day, which is half a bottle of wine a day. No cirrhosis whatever. The risk of cirrhosis only kicks in at 80 grams a day, which is about a bottle and a bit of wine. So in fact, there are definite risks. But even with these post-mortems, it does only 25% of people have this problem. So most people who drink don't get cirrhosis ever, however much they drink. So it's actually a phony scare story again. And liver cancer also, you might think it's a liver cancer problem connection, but actually the connection is called by the World Health Organization possible connection. So they're not even sure that there's a liver cancer connection anyway themselves, and these are the anti-alcohol people themselves.
Okay, and the last question for you is, in your book, what's the most interesting or unusual statistic that you came across?
I think the most interesting thing in the book is the calorie issue, because that is the most counterintuitive. I also think the fact that drinkers live longer than non-drinkers is a massive, massive boost to one's quality of life. You know, you can now drink without fear or guilt.
All right then, Tony, thank you very much for your time. Have a great day. And the book's called The Good News About Booze, Tony Edwards, 12 quid at Amazon. All right, cheers very much.